Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm with Veterans for Peace Chapter 92, Daniel Ellsberg Chapter in Seattle. And today we're going to talk about nuclear weapons proliferation, causes and effects, and that sort of thing. And with me today are, and this is actually being broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM, and also will be archived at VFP92.org. With me today are Carl Wyken, Dr. Carl Wyken, and Mary Hansen, who's a longtime peace activist in Seattle. Without further ado, I'll let Carl start in sort of a start his comments on this important subject. Go ahead, Carl. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mike. As Mike said, I'm a physician who's relatively new to the Seattle area, but did my residency in the Tacoma area, at a federally qualified health center, and have now a deeper understanding of the long-term effects of nuclear proliferation and nuclear testing and nuclear war on peoples. And that's why I'm here today to share what I've learned and share part of my journey to becoming more active in this arena.
Can you give me a little bit of information about that journey, and also any specifics you want to bring up?
Oh, sure. I can go into plenty of detail. So let's start by figuring out how, so I'll explain how I've arrived here. So I'll tell you that if you had talked to me in, let's say 10 years ago or even 8 years ago, and importantly in 2017, there was an important juncture in my life, in 2017. I had a little later in life had finally gotten the opportunity to go to medical school. I'd worked very hard to do so. I had a background, have a background in elite human performance. Was had worked for the Olympic Committee prior to that, had run a human performance lab, basically like knew how to make people, if they wanted to perform at a very, very high level. And a lot of people paid lots of money to have my expertise to help them in whatever sport pursuit, whatever thing that it might be. And in 2017 I got an opportunity to go to medical school. At that time, because I was so into human performance, it actually made very good sense, financially and from a from a job perspective to, sign on to the US military, which I did. I signed on to the US military in 2017, to pay for medical school because, you can imagine that's an enormous expense. Medical schools now, and I think this is, something an important point to bring up. My medical school bill, was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $350,000. That's, tuition plus, the living expense expenses during that time. I'll explain why I know that number now. But so I took the opportunity and decided to to go through with being part of of military medicine. Went through medical school. Medical school is hard, as you'd expect, it's tough. We did a few sort of minor military exercises during that time. I was actually involved in a military heavy medical school. It wasn't a military medical school in and of itself, but it was one that was that had a lot of military members in it, and so we did some practice stuff, practice deployments and things like that during it. And then COVID hit, and that was really tough on my wife and myself. And so we made a life decision to move from Colorado Springs, where, she had relocated to be with me during my last 2 years of medical school, back out here to the Puget Sound, where her family is from, so that, she can kind of resettle and everything. And that was when I, said to the military, "Hey, I don't think I'm going to do a military residency. I think I'm going to do a civilian residency so that I can go back to the Puget Sound where my wife needs to be, so that our family can be taken care of." And so I successfully did that. I successfully asked the military to allow me to do that, and they did. So I did a residency in Tacoma, Washington, the South Sound, and in one of the rougher areas of Tacoma. And that was starting in 2021 through 2024. And this is how we're getting closer to being here. During that residency, which was also pretty difficult, as you can imagine, it's family practice. I was around a lot of people who were, you were just was just destitute. It was just tough. They're seeking medical care. Maybe, many did not have insurance. This healthcare facility I was at was just a sort of a catch-all for those who didn't have access to other care, and so we saw a lot of very, very, very sick people. That taught me a lot, of course. So some of those programs are some of the best programs to go through as a physician because you learn so much about medicine. You really become good at the really scary stuff, and you come out into regular outpatient medicine, you go, "Oh, this is nothing compared to what I saw in residency." And so that's why, programs in the inner city are very competitive for residency. I think of things like, Baltimore or New York or LA, where there's a lot of poverty and a lot of desperation, and diseases. One of those populations that I saw during residency, that at the time didn't make a ton of sense to me at the time, and it was just sort of another population that was having trouble, but they were the Marshallese. Those were descendants of people from the Marshall Islands. And honestly, at the time, I just thought, "Oh my gosh, I've got another Marshallese patient. I'm not going to be able to find a translator." That was the only real, substantive thought I had at the time, because it's just another one of the populations that has a lot of trouble. And so didn't sink into me too hard. But I would say that a lot, kind of in parallel to that, I realized that, the military, life, was not going to align with my family's needs, my wife's needs, my own needs. It just was going to be like oil and water. It was not going to work out. Mental health things and other issues. So I said to the military, "Hey, I need to resign. I'll pay you all the money, and I need to resign." After some back and forth, they eventually said, "No, you're too important. You're a doctor, and your things that you're reporting are just not severe enough for us to really care." Which, as a physician, really hurt. You think, "Oh gosh, well, because I'm a physician, my concerns don't matter, because I'm that important, I suppose." But that sort of put me in a position where now I have to report for duty, but I know that I'm not good for the job. And even when I report for duty, they decide I'm not good for the job. But because the central part of the military had said, "Oh no, you're going to do the job," the sort of lowly people like myself and the people around me couldn't do anything to get me out. So I was stuck. And this stuck position started in February of 2025. And so since February of 2025, so since February of this year, I have gone to the base every day without any assignment and no ability to use my license because the military has decided that I both have also cannot do my job because of the concerns I reported in medical school. Now I think it or in residency. Now I think it's really important to say that like nothing has I've never hurt anybody. There's never been any concern of patient harm. But I said, hey, I need to make this adult decision to say, no, this is not going to work out. So before anybody thinks, oh, well, this guy, might cause some harm. There's nothing. And I just said, this is something I need to do for my own health and the health of others. And the military said no. So that's we'll put that aside for the moment. And starting in February, I really had to sit and think about what was going on, why I was there, and what to do next. Because I had, gone through, at this point, 12 plus years of training and said, now I can't do my job. I haven't done really well up until that point. So I really started to think deeply and went to some healthcare mental health providers, and eventually it came up that there may be something deeper going on in terms of your misalignment or disalignment with the military. What's going on? Meaning like, are you really, or is it a mental health thing, or is it something deeper, like you don't agree with what's going on? And after lots and lots of reflection, things started to crack, and things in the past that had happened, it started to make sense. Like, maybe it wasn't that I was like just depressed. Maybe I was actually in disagreement and wasn't actually voicing those things, wasn't allowing myself to think, no, this is the wrong thing to be doing. Maybe those military exercises, those simulated military exercises back in medical school that I really hated, maybe it wasn't just that they were annoying and I had, poor sleep because of them. Maybe there was something deeper going on. And another thing that's important to the story is during medical school and during residency, I had become increasingly interested in something called functional medicine. And functional medicine is it, the best way to explain it is like the root of the root of the root cause medicine. So you're looking at everything you possibly can to look into a person's history to figure out why something has happened to them or why they're sick with X and Y disease. It's not just like, oh, here's, you're diabetic, here's some medication. It's, what happened in your life that has led up to this? And not just your life, but maybe the life of your mother or the life of your father or generations before. What's leading up to this? So that could include exposures to certain things in utero, or it could include socioeconomic status, food access, even transportation, pollution, those sorts of things. You're really looking deep. And I realized that some of the things that were happening in my residency were because of really deep societal problems. The why were some of these people coming to me in my residency who were super, super sick? Well, some of the things I would say during residency was like, they don't need me, they need a social worker, right? They don't need me to tell them what medication to go on. They just need to be able to eat a vegetable, right? Things like that. So effectively, I spent a really long time, or a deep, a shorter time, right? Because it's only been 7 months since that February start date, but a really deep, intense time thinking about why am I here and what has gone on to get me here and what do I really care about? And then in April of 2025, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and the then Washington Against Nuclear Weapons, but now Northwest Against Nuclear Weapons, put on a joint conference about nuclear abolition and what we're doing in we the what is the current status of the nuclear abolition movement look like? I didn't know much about this, but I had worked with WPSR in the past during residency, and really thought, gosh, these are people I really can align with. This is a message I can really align with. These are causes that I can really get along with. And for those of you who don't know, WPSR has, three main missions, and one is nuclear disarmament, two is economic inequality, and three is climate change. So these three main task forces they have, those are what they work on. So I went to this conference and it changed everything about how I was thinking because it pulled out of me things that I had suppressed for years. And the most poignant of those for our discussion today is that I finally understood why the Marshallese people at my residency were so disproportionately sick compared to every other population that I was treating. And in particular, it made me remember a couple instances. One instance of like a 35-year-old male, so about my age and when I was in residency, 35-year-old male who was doing all the right things that I knew from a functional medicine standpoint and as a performance physiologist. Like he was doing his exercise, he was eating really well, he had a job, he was trying to do all the right things and still was super sick, like terrible diabetes and a weird autoimmune disorder. For those not in medicine or in primary care, certainly a male, first of all, with an autoimmune disorder is weird. And a male in his 30s with an autoimmune disorder is super weird. That doesn't happen very often. Much more common in women, much more common in women over the age of 40 or 50. And so, yeah, that just didn't make sense to me. And then I remember another instance of a pregnant Marshallese who I tried to do, help out with the primary care or the prenatal care rather for her. And it was just so difficult because she was sick, had terrible diabetes, couldn't get on the medication that she needed. Just layers and layers of problems that made her prenatal care very difficult and the delivery of her baby very, very difficult. Things including like she probably only had about a third grade education. She had only a few teeth, but she was 40. She was just a couple of years older than I was at the time. And so that thought I thought this is weird. This is just this shouldn't happen. So I sat in that conference and realized that so much of what was happening with the Marshallese was due to the root cause of their problems, which was the complete annihilation of their islands, of their home, by the Bravo testing. In the 1950s, basically. And during that conference, I finally learned or finally came up in my mind, and I couldn't push back down that the Marshallese had been promised that if they participated in this testing, that they were contributing to the end of all war. And so when they heard that message, they said, ah, this is something good to do, right? We should do that. And the US will protect us, right? And we'll be contributing to the end of all war. And Goodness, what at the time, who would not want that after coming out of World War II? And the horrors of essentially back-to-back world wars, who would not want to sign on to, oh, I'm going to end all war? Well, unfortunately, we know that it didn't. And we now have a better understanding of what we did to those islands. But really, what we continue to do with nuclear proliferation. And these people, the Marshallese are just an example, but they're one of the most, dire examples of what militarism does to indigenous peoples around the world. But any of us can be considered indigenous if we go back to our homelands. So it's a silly qualification to say, no, it's only to indigenous people. It's to everybody. If I were to go back to, to my, homeland, quote unquote, of northern Germany, right? There's plenty of militarism that going on there that why am I here, right? How did I get here? Well, my great-great-grandfather immigrated because he said, I don't want any of this anymore. With the Prussian buildup. And so I'm effectively a descendant of militarism problems. And so it affects everybody. And what I finally saw was that I, having been part of the military and continuing to sign on to that, was contributing to furthering of this of militarism and preparation for war, and really like undermining the very thing that I thought was so important to me, undermining the idea that I understand root cause medicine, and if I go deep enough, I can help people become healthy. Well, I can't do that if I'm actively causing them to be unhealthy by saying, yeah, but we need your islands to blow them up so that we can fight off other things that haven't happened, right? Or that have the potential not to happen. But that's kind of another story. So in the end, I signed or I submitted an application to be a conscientious objector because I said, this I can't any longer. I cannot allow my hands and my skills to be promoting killing and violence. This doesn't make sense. I'm trying to make people as healthy as possible. And all I'm doing, if I am a military physician, is undermining that very thing. So I took it upon myself to learn as much as I could, and I'm continuing to learn about the horrors of nuclear war for one, but nuclear proliferation, nuclear power, but basically us messing with things that should stay on the sun, and stay far away from us. Us playing God is only getting us closer to our own death. And as a physician, I can't endorse that. I just plain can't endorse that. Every time I think, oh, well, I'm doing something better. This is, we got to have some pain for some gain in a sense. Like we got to go through this, testing to see if we can move on to something better or to keep our world peaceful. Every time I think through that and go through the logic of that, I go, yeah, but do we have to do that? And the answer is always no. We don't have to go and resort to violence, or the threat of annihilation to get what we want, to progress as a society. So here now, it's all, I hope that that gives you that's plenty of context to say I'm here now as a military physician who has applied as a conscientious objector. And am now learning how to commit my energy to the idea of nonviolence as a whole, but through the avenues of demilitarization, non-proliferation, and helping others understand that nuclear energy and power and war and all the down chain effects all have deep effects on all of us. And if we're not paying attention, we're messing with our own annihilation. So I'm here to help as much as I can. I'm young in this movement, but feel that it's very important for people like me to start speaking up and quit waiting for things to get better.
Well, thank you, Carl. Actually, yours is a very important voice. It's particularly important because you're a younger person and a veteran. One question, how many or have you had discussions about this issues that you came to realize was important to you with other doctors, military doctors in particular?
Yes. I'm here at I'm being careful not to tell you exactly where I am. I am at a military clinic, and around me are people who, because I think it's important to point out that the people around me are nice people. They're good people. I think most of the people in the military, if not all of them, are good people, but have found their way into, just like I did, found their way into the military. And so I've had really deep discussions with some of the other physicians with me, and it's fascinating and terrifying to realize that they don't really push back very much at all. In fact, the only argument they give is, well, the world's not perfect, and so I can't make a difference, is basically what they're saying to me, because the world is the way the world is. And I say, yes, but does it have to be? Mike, to your point, over the last couple of weeks, I started to have this particular discussion with the other physicians around me, and I pose a thought experiment. And the thought experiment goes like this. Say, so if you take to the extreme the risk, the ultimate risk of being either in the military and carrying a weapon and being a combatant, which, to be fair, doctors do not do, but for the thought experiment, if you carry a weapon and you become a militant, what is your ultimate risk? Well, the ultimate risk to you is that you become captured, tortured, and put to death, right? That is your ultimate risk, right? For you personally. And okay, so that's pretty well known. What though, on the complete alternative to that, is your risk of being a nonviolent peacemaker, somebody who stands up in the and speaks for nonviolence? Well, we have very good examples of this. We have Gandhi, King, we have Jesus, we have Romero. Basically, all of them tortured and put to death, okay, in some way or another. So the thought experiment then reveals, okay, well, your risk, your personal risk, is exactly the same no matter which road you go down. Because when you go against the grain of either, of your, like, stay in your lanes, or don't do anything, don't mess with society, if you go on either extreme, you run the risk of becoming tortured and put to death. So then I say, well, if you had a choice, if you knew that those things were equated, would you choose the side of hurting people to be tortured and put to death, or trying not to hurt people and being tortured and put to death? And to me, the answer becomes then completely clear. Like, I'm not going to try to hurt people to only achieve the same outcome, right? And I think that most people would answer that if they had to, but most people don't have to answer this question. And so when I pose that question to other physicians, usually it's met with silence, which means it's very uncomfortable for them to think through that.
Just one more question. Can you hear me now? The other question is, outside of talking with your colleagues, I suppose it's one thing to say that you'd be as out front and public as you are, and another thing to say, well, yes, I oppose nuclear weapons, but I'm not going to be public about it. There seems like there's sort of different responses among others. Did you encounter that, or
A
just
little bit.
silence?
Yeah, mostly just silence. And it's mostly, like I said, it's a combination of the answers, whereas where it's like, well, yeah, I mean, nuclear weapons are clearly bad, but we need them, right? It becomes the argument of deterrence, right? Well, we need them so that we don't get blown up, right? Which is sort of which when you take that to its full, end point of logic, that doesn't make any sense, right? Because the weapon will blow up at some point unless it is completely disassembled, right? That's the end point of that machine. It is designed to blow up and will blow up with any all with any agitation, whether that's through war or through other means, unless it's disassembled. So, I think out of that, I certainly could have just said, you know what? And this is actually what my father wants me to do. And if he ever hears this, I'm sorry, this is what he's told me in his words and not his words, is that he's thinking, yeah, well, you could just, go through my contract. It's 4 years. It's not that big of a deal. I'll probably never be deployed to some, crazy area or whatever. And I just think, even if that were the case, which I don't think it's possible in these times, but even if that were the case, can I really sit with myself? And again, as I said before, like, can I just allow myself to wait for things to get better? Or am I the voice that I've been waiting and hoping somebody would be? For forever. And that's really the realization that I've come to is like, well, look, the world's on fire right now. So are you just gonna sit there and wait for it to get better? Or are you gonna do something about it? Because the reality is we're kind of all headed toward some pretty bad times. And so all the things I'm holding dear, my house income, everything, all that stuff may not matter, right? We've seen this before. We're about 100 years, from the last big, horrible depression, where even, physicians who were theoretically well off, or okay, I shouldn't say well off, but were okay, they felt the effects of the depression just as anyone else. They were standing in lines trying to get food. So if that's my fate, then I may as well stand up and not be waiting for somebody else to do it. But it's terrifying. It's still terrifying.
Mike, you're muted.
Thank you for your story now, and I was wondering if Mary, you had some comments or questions for Carl?
I'm just really happy to hear the full story, the context, because I really think that perspective of understand of being willing to see things as they really are, the courage that it takes to see things as they really are, is pretty rare. And I encounter the same problem that Carl does. And I've been at this, I'm almost 80, and I've been at this, like since I realized when I when I read Dan Ellsberg and I understood that the United States had threatened to use nuclear weapons over 23 times. This is in 1984. How close, and I understood how close we had come, how many times, that whole thing. But what really is similar, the betrayal at the heart of the whole thing. I was at Stanford and I was dealing with anti-war protests in the 60s, in the very late 60s, early 70s. And David Packard was the head of the of Hewlett Packard. He was the head of the or he was working as an undersecretary of defense. And he was really key to the establishment of Trident. Okay, the nuclear, you know, the main the submarine-based nuclear missile that's at the heart of the nuclear so-called deterrent. And that was a massive betrayal because according to not just David Packard, but according to the people around him as well, nuclear weapons were going to make things safer because they were not going to be very accurate. So that having a nuclear weapon that wasn't particularly accurate was going to mean that deterrence was going to work. Well, as soon as they got that nuclear weapon, they did everything they could to make it as accurate as it could possibly be. So something that they had sold on the basis that it would be stabilizing turned into something that is out of control, not stabilizing. So that it just echoed for me what happened to the Marshallese about being promised that having their islands bombed was going to lead to peace. Yeah. So I think my anger, that's at the heart, at the very, very core of my anger, and that promoted, that's helped in a way to keep me willing to look at the reality as much as I possibly can over these many, many years since, say, 1984, so figured out. That feeling of betrayal, I think, is essential that the American people are being betrayed. We're being told that something is defending us when it's essentially threatening us. And it's not just threatening us, it's threatening the entire world that we love and depend on. So I think that is motivating to people if they can hear that message. I don't think it's very motivating to people sometimes when we go way into the weeds about this or that weapon system, even though that matters. But I think what really matters is that we continue to be betrayed. Our money, our energy, our intelligence, everything gets fed into this. Into the maw of militarism. It's an addiction. It's a very serious addiction. So my sense is that how can people who are experts in dealing with addiction help us to get a message that's going to be more resonant with, I mean, more resonant, I'm sorry, with average people, because I think we're really well-intended. I do. I think anti-nuclear people are amazing and well-intended, but I don't think that the message that we've had has been particularly effective. And I feel it, that the invisible shield that makes all our messages bounce off as well with some better approaches. And I think Carl's onto a lot. I really like functional medicine. I think that I've been very much influenced by some of the writers on functional medicine. It makes so much sense. So I'm excited. I think it's a I think these are fruitful fruitful beginnings. Some of it, I think you know, you plug in, some of it is already on the shelf, if you will. It just needs to be pulled off the shelf and plugged in. And then some of it needs to be refined and reinvented. But I think that we can do, the answer is we can do better than we have been, but we don't have to abandon everything that we have been doing. We may have to reframe it a lot, and look at it with new eyes. So I appreciate that Carl has new eyes and he's looking at it in a new way. And I'm hoping that some of us almost 80-year-olds can be receptive to allowing some of what Carl has been saying to influence how we're thinking.
Well, Carl's voice and yours are very important. And one of the reasons that they're important is because it's a personal connection with what the issue is. Carl's is very personal, and so is yours too. And I'd add mine to that sort of thing. One of the reasons that Veterans for Peace is an effective organization is that as veterans, we have experience with military and militarism, so we can speak with authority. And like Carl and like you, I mean, your longtime experience. I'll be 81 in December, so I've been around this stuff for a long time. And one of the reasons I do this is you might call it compulsive obsessive behavior, but also because it's necessary. It's necessary. It's also therapeutic. And it gives you something to actually say something and do something, which is a way of not losing, hope and be optimistic about this. And actually, as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, most of the people in this country do not support nuclear weapons. That the proliferation of, including our hideous sort of expansion and projected expansion of our nuclear capability, which is on in the works. So I mean there is and I agree with you, Mary, that there is a Americans are not bloodthirsty people, as actually quite generous in many respects. So the political leadership is another thing, and actually I would actually agree for many of the people in the military, including the senior military commands, they are not exactly big fans of nuclear weapons, because they know quite well. I mean, this is what they go to the war college for, is what these things can do. So these are the, I mean, yours are important voices, and having this personal connection is very, very important. I think, Mary, you're quite right that one of the other objections to militarism, as a result of, say, most recently, say the Blue Angels or something like that, is for its environmental sort of liabilities, and the military is one of the United States military is one of the most polluting entities in the world. All they have to do is look around at the groundwater samples of any military base, and the pollution in the groundwater is just endemic. So the Physicians for Social Responsibility, I think, is very very important part of this anti-nuclear campaign. And can you mention some more specific things about how that organization works, and as far as with their anti-nuclear outlook?
Sure. So as I mentioned, and as Mike's alluding to, I'm a member of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. Just as an aside, I'm also a member of Veterans for Peace, and also a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists. But Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility is one of the leading Physicians for Social Responsibility, or PSR, affiliates. So each state has its opportunity for an affiliate, and Washington is one of the leaders in the affiliates. And as I mentioned, it has those three task forces: nuclear disarmament, climate change, climate action, and economic inequality. And so, the nuts and bolts, in a sense, is we meet monthly. As a task force, and this is of physician members, but also anybody who's a member of the organization at large who wants to work on a specific topic, meets together. And just like any other or activism organization, it's a way to organize to say, hey, these are the things that are these are the specific actions that we're taking. These are the protests that we're showing up at. These are the congressional representatives that we are trying to talk to. These are the organizations, these are the other organizations in this space that are doing X, Y, or Z thing. So, our meeting that we incidentally had last night circled, centered around, a recent, for instance, an event where we were trying to bring on more young people into the nuclear disarmament movement. We helped sponsor a pilgrimage to go to some of the different nuclear sites, both here in Washington and over in Japan. So that's one aspect. We also talked about the specific representatives that we are trying to get to sign on to either a resolution to bring back the New START Treaty, which is set to expire in February of 2026, or talking to local municipalities to say we're going to declare a nuclear disarmament or anti-nuclear stance as a municipality or as a local government to create a semi-grassroots movement to help build momentum to say, hey, there are all these cities that are also saying we need to be anti-nuclear. Then you present that up to the higher levels of government, and then the policymakers can't really ignore that as easily. So, it's organizing 101, right? We just happen to be centered around being physicians, but that does not mean that you have to be a physician to join or to support PSR or WPSR. But it's very similar to what we do in Veterans for Peace meetings or in other activism sort of organizations.
Well, it's critical that, as you mentioned, I think it's critical to actually the organization to include younger people in this, because they're the ones that are actually going to be carrying the issue and the fight forward. And as I understand it, they're very open to this sort of information, and are willing to actually, and do something actually in this as useful as, say, contacting their elected representatives, and also actually like protesting in the streets. Other organizations that should be mentioned is a long time local long time is Ground Zero, Bremerton based Kitsap Peninsula, who's been doing this activism for decades, really, an important organization. So. Yeah, I that the inclusion of younger people in Veterans for Peace in particular is a something that's really been foremost in the people who are in Veterans for Peace now, because they are the voice of the future, really, and they seem to don't have the same hang-ups that, say, my generation or people close to my generation have about nuclear weapons or military and that sort of thing, where there's the opt-out or the standard default excuse or argument is, we need these things, and if we didn't have them, somebody else would use them, that sort of thing. But of course, the issue is that sort of those kind of opinions are influenced by generations of points of view, which basically says there's nothing wrong with having a military, and a military that's, in the case of the United States, a very aggressive one, and spends a lot of its time overseas fighting its wars, almost all of its, certainly since the Second World War. Anyway, the
If I could just jump in here
go
for a
ahead,
second.
please.
Yeah, I think a key thing is recognizing that to be a human is an essential part of being a human is to want to feel secure. And
Thank you.
that's a good thing that a human
Right.
being wants to feel secure. It's just that feeling, that need, and that reality is betrayed by militarism. It does not produce security, but that's all you need. You know, it's like all these weapon systems, why do people not cr become critical of them and understand? Well, people just have a, what do you call it, a shortcut in their brain that goes to saying it makes me feel safer. It doesn't make me safer, it makes me feel safer. So that the more chaos, like what we've got now, the more you increase chaos, then people feel what? Less secure. So what do they want more of? Militarism, short circuit, anything to make them feel secure, but it isn't. So I think the good news is our ground truth, our main message is true. And the thing that we're opposed to is an illusion. So that's pretty strong, you know. But the fact is that people want to have that short-term feeling of security at almost all costs. So it's creating this invisible shield that our message bounces off. And it's very
Yeah.
frustrating when that happens. So I think it's amazing, Carl, that you went to that conference. I didn't go because of my age, and I hate to say it, but my fear of COVID was still pretty active right there, and I was avoiding in-person stuff, but I did watch the videos of it. But it's encouraging to me that that conference was important to you and meaningful to you, because one of the things I think we'll learn how to do is combine, you know, online and conferences, live stuff, in ways that have meaning for people. So I hope that's not the last conference like that, so that maybe future conferences will have even more meaning for more younger people, but more people. The other point I would just make is that I think we shouldn't ever be ageist and say that there's no value to what we've been doing. I think there's been terrific value to what a lot of old people, our seniors. I mean, Dan Ellsberg isn't with us anymore, but wow, what value. So, not valuing what you can do as an older person, I think is a horrible loss that doesn't have to happen. I really respect the people in Veterans for Peace, Vietnam veterans, and I consider myself a veteran of the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
We have some of the same. So anyway, that's kind of my take on it, is I hope that older people also don't feel discouraged.
Well, those are important points, particularly the personal ones. And you know, in particular, nuclear weapons, the argument, the any argument supporting nuclear weapon is an insane argument. And there is absolutely no logic, even a Jesuitical argument for the use of nuclear or possession or something. That's why the provisions of the nuclear test ban proliferation treaty is important because it's against the production, the use, possession of nuclear weapons. So again, nuclear weapons, the argument for nuclear weapons is a lunatic one. And I'd say probably the best sort of thing is to watch Dr. Strangelove, which is a 60-year-old film, more than 60-year-old film, but still very relevant because of the lunacy of these people. And these people who are supporting and promoting nuclear weapons are lunatics. I don't know if we can end on that or not, but anyway, that's one way of looking at it anyway. So we're just about out of time. So my name is Mike Dietrich, and this is where Veterans for Peace, and I want to thank Mary Hansen and Carl Ryken for coming on and contributing to this discussion about nuclear weapons and their personal remarks about it, which are very important to this movement. And this program will be broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM, fourth Wednesday of the month. If you want to listen to it, you can go to KODX 96.9, click on programs, and then click on Veterans for Peace radio show. So this is Mike Dietrich signing off. Thanks again to my guests, Mary and Carl. All right.